Well, church, when we've been together over these last number of weeks, we have been tackling this concept of what does it mean to be the people of God? Who are we as God's people? And we started off by talking about our identity, that we are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession. And we suggested that we ought to order our lives around that truth and that existence. The next time we were together, we remembered that Jesus is our head, not earthly government, not earthly religious leaders, not even local religious leaders, and not even us as individuals. And so if Jesus is our head, then everything we do should be about and for him and in submission to him. And then we talked about the joy of unity, of valuing our togetherness above our own preferences. And last time when we were together, we talked about our uniquenesses and our giftedness and how God has uniquely gifted and prepared us in order to strengthen and build up the church. And today, what we want to talk about is this idea of togetherness. What does it mean to live together, to share life? And to do that, we want to turn to a pretty famous passage of Scripture. Maybe this is the one that's popping up in your brains as I'm talking about that. And that's Acts chapter 2. In Acts chapter 2, you have the beginning of the gathered church. And it's a pretty impressive picture of the livelihood of this church. And so I want to read that with you. If you've got the Bible app, you can do it there, or feel free to just listen as I read Acts chapter 2, verse 42. It says, "They," that is the church, the believers, the people of God, "devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship, to the breaking of bread and to prayer. Everyone was filled with awe at the many wonders and signs performed by the apostles. All the believers were together and had everything in common. They sold property and possessions to give to anyone who had need. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved." So right from Jump Street in the church, we have this idea not only of a theoretical unity and a theoretical belief in individual importance and giftedness, but the reality of sharing life together. Now, if you're anything like me or many of the people that I talk to, this particular passage of Scripture is incredibly overwhelming and perhaps frightening. And so I need to give you some caveats here at the beginning. The first is that this teaching or this talk this morning is not meant to overwhelm you, nor, and hear me on this, is it meant to make you feel guilty for something you're not doing. That's not my purpose, nor do I think is that the purpose of Acts chapter 2. But what I do want to do, and I think what Acts chapter 2 is getting at, is I want to help us see the why. Why is this kind of sharing of life significant? And then, if you stick with me that long, hopefully that will make sense. And then we'll jump into, just really quickly, a one step into how. How do I even begin to do something like this? So, have you ever been to a restaurant and you ordered a meal and you were really excited about it, and then it came out and it was so enormous that you didn't know how to begin to attack it, and it almost like just did your appetite in and you felt like, I can't even do this. There's a movie from the 80s that I remember when I was a kid with John Candy. He takes his family camping in the summer. I think it's called The Great Outdoors. They go camping in the summer, and they go to this big steak place, and there's this challenge to see who can eat this giant steak. And if you do that, I don't know, you get a T-shirt and your name on the wall or something like that. And so John Candy, of course, is coerced by his family to try to do this, and it comes out, and it is enormous, and it's overwhelming. And of course, if you remember that, he finishes it, and he's overwhelmed by finishing it, and then they force him to eat all the fat and all the gristle and then even some of the bone matters, and he does it, and it's overwhelming, and by the end of it, he just collapses. I think sometimes when we read Acts chapter 2, listen to me, particularly if you tend to be introverted or if you are really busy in life, and most of us are one of those two things, right? Or maybe some of us are both of them. It's like that experience in the great outdoors of a giant steak that you know is good, but it's so overwhelming, and to even give yourself into it is going to completely take everything from you. And what I want to suggest to you is the story in Acts chapter 2 is both descriptive and prescriptive. That it does in fact show us a way that we are intended to live, but it does not show us the exact way that we are intended to live. That is, that Acts chapter 2 does happen within the context of a real society, time, and age of life that is quite different from our current experience. And to not acknowledge that and to simply say we should be like that is to misunderstand the scriptures and literature in general. But to simply say, well, that was then and this is now, is to miss the point of the livelihood of the church when the church is at its very best. And so I want to invite you into a non-overwhelming, right, just trust me, a non-overwhelming consideration of what would it mean to believe that sharing our lives, not just our Sunday morning together, but our lives outside of here, in part, what would it mean? Why could it be important, and how could we do it? So let's think about this. Why is this happening in Acts chapter 2? And I think I can say with pretty significant certainty that the picture of the church in the New Testament is nearly universally a first-person plural picture, right? That is, that the church and the people of God, Old Testament, quite frankly, and New Testament, is much more we than it is me, right? You with me on this? That it is much more first-person plural, and I would say almost universally first-person plural, we, rather than me. And you might say, well, God's redemptive plan, what he's done is individual, and that's incredibly true and really important. There are individual impacts in our life that God has redeemed you, that he has dealt with your sin, that he's called you to himself. But I would suggest to you the full experience of and understanding of that reality only happens in the context of community. And that's why when Peter is talking to his people, he doesn't say, you are individual persons of God. He says you are collectively the people of God. You are not a chosen person. You are a chosen people. Because somehow in this experience of community, in the sharing of lives, we get an even fuller sense of exactly what God has, is, and will do in our world and in our lives. The truth is that the experience of the gospel naturally leads us to share our lives together. That's why the Apostle John in 1 John chapter 1 says that if you walk in the light, that is, that if you are a gospel person, if you've embraced the gospel and are attempting to follow Jesus, he says you will have fellowship with God and fellowship with one another. This word fellowship is an interesting word. It's the Greek word koinonia. And it was a very common experience, not just in the church in the first century, but in the first century world, especially in social clubs and in social clusters. It was the experience of koinonia in these places was a sense of identity, a sense of belonging, a sense of significance that came from being part of a group of people, part of a significant movement of people. And what I would suggest to you is, in as much as your identity is cemented individually in Christ, and that is true, the fullest experience of it is when you are joined into it together with God's people, not just yourself. Moreover, koinonia rises out. This idea of fellowship is not just a scheduled lunch, right? It's not just a room in the basement of an older church. It rises out of this idea of shared experience and shared belief that almost miraculously joins people together. We can see this in our modern world sometimes, right? We see it in the genre of sports, where a passion and a love for a particular sports team can unite people who are very different from each other and can cause them to have a kindredness that they otherwise would not share. We saw this in Philadelphia when the Eagles won the Super Bowl and the parade that was going all through Philadelphia and the video cameras catching all kinds of different people who would not otherwise be together but for this reality, this passion for the Eagles and this celebration of a great victory. I would suggest to you, as a diehard Eagles fan, that the gospel and the victory of Jesus in his resurrection is even more powerful than that. And it joins us together as we celebrate the true victory of God in his resurrection. It's what leads the early church to do crazy things like sell some of their stuff to care for people who were in need. Why does that even happen? Because they believed that the cause of the gospel and the lordship of Jesus were that much more significant than their individual existence, that it was worth it to be part of the people collectively than to be the person individually. You don't get there because you say, well, God told me I have to do this. That's religion. That doesn't work. But a true belief in the gospel somehow leads us into this reality of fellowship that somehow changes how we orient our lives. And so we have in this description of the early church that they were devoted. Did you catch that word? Devoted to fellowship. Devoted to this experience of koinonia. And the word devoted is a fantastic word. It speaks of not just passion, but it speaks of perseverance. That is, that they were committed to it, not just excited about it. My guess is they probably all the time weren't extraordinarily excited about it. My guess is that introversion was not just a 20th century or 21st century reality, but also a first century reality. My guess is that they were incredibly busy people too, busy in different ways than us, but incredibly busy, and their livelihoods were dependent upon it. They had vocations and they had realities, but somehow the gospel led to a sense of persistence and perseverance in togetherness, because true identity in the gospel was found there. So, I said earlier that Acts chapter 2 is both prescriptive and descriptive, right? That is, that we can't just take that and say we have to look just like that so that every day we're having these giant meals together and we all are selling our stuff and giving it to other people. That's not the case. But it is descriptive, descriptively prescriptive in the sense that it shows the value of togetherness. Now, I just want to pause and I want to describe our present modern experience and also suggest to you that it is not prescriptive, that you do not have to simply blindly believe what the world tells you about how you ought to orient your life today. Because whereas the vision of the New Testament church is almost universally described in the first person plural, we, the vision of the Western modern American life is almost universally described in the first person singular, me, as opposed to we. And of course, this is the natural product of the Enlightenment project, where the gathering of knowledge was more important than anything, and then ultimately into the modernity reality of the individual above all else as the individual thinker, to the reality of relativism, where I also can now make my own truth. You see this continual siloing of ourselves, and into the American experience of rugged individualism being valued above all else. That you are a self-made woman or a self-made man. Nothing could be more valued or honored than being that. And yet, the New Testament says the most honored and valued thing ought to be being a gospel-formed person that naturally happens in community. What I would suggest to you is that the modern amalgam, the modern concoction of me, is a dangerous recipe for the experience of full life. It's why you are pursuing it and not really tasting it. Because even in the pursuit of your relationships, when we are subtly given to this modern experience of me above we, nearly all of our relationships, if they are stripped bare and if we are forced to be honest, are actually about what you can get from them. Even some of the closest relationships that you might have, to a spouse or a super close friend, to a parent or to a child. The identity that you gain from it, the power that you get from it, the affection that you gain from it. And we can see in that, even as valuable and as important as relationships are to us, the subtle way in which our corrupt hearts mislead us. And of course, I would suggest to you that this overflows massively into the experience of church that we have in our contemporary world. It is that we have grown to believe that church is significant in so much as what I can gain from it. It's a me over we experience. And the most significant moments of church are individual experiences. I don't mean that meaning that you're alone or isolated, but it's the experience that you have versus the experience of the people of God. Now again, my point this morning is not to give you some massive conviction or to have you leave here feeling terrible about yourself or feeling like you're imperfect. I would suggest to you we are all imperfect, so to experience your imperfection is actually an opportunity for gospel growth. That's not a bad thing. But I don't want this to be a negative reality. I simply want us to be honest. That in so much as, yeah, we can't say that we need to just pick Acts 2 out of its context and make it happen now, and that's what how it has to be. We also can't say that our current experience and setup of life is how it's supposed to be either. Instead, we have to figure out how we go after this reality of togetherness. Because it's clear that God calls the church to be that way. So let's ask the question, why? Why does God have this communal vision of the church? And I would give you two reasons. I think there are probably many more than this, but two for our purposes this morning. The first is that we cannot care for ourselves, right? We cannot completely care for ourselves. And your care is significant to your Father in heaven. God loves you and wants you to be well cared for. And a major way in which he intends to care for you is through the care of his people, the church. Now again, in our modern Western American individual world, I'm trying to turn as best I can away from this wind without being completely back to you guys. in our Western world is the greatest reality is if you could do it all by yourself and didn't need anyone else. Somehow we've bought into that nonsense in the world. And yet, in so doing, what we've said is we are rejecting God's plan for care for us. How do we know that we can't care for ourselves? How do we know that it's through shared life that care is supposed to happen? There are 45 some passages in the New Testament that speak of one another, right? Care for one another, love one another, encourage one another. All of these speak to the reality of a God who intends to care for his people through the relational connectivity of his people. Moreover, we can look right to the story of creation, where God, in looking at his creation and calling it very good, also recognized that it was not good for humanity to be alone. And so he created woman and man to be together. And while there's certainly biblical precedent and significance to the covenant of marriage happening there, it is also a testament to the reality that humanity at its best is plural, not singular. And of course, the corruption of humanity in the chapters that follow lead not only to the loss of fellowship between God and man, but of also the loss of fellowship between man and man, where a brother literally asks the question, am I my brother's keeper? And of course, we know the answer is yes. That is how God created us to be. So much so that in his letter to the Galatians, Paul reminds us that when we carry each other's burdens, we fulfill the law of Christ. It is in these shared relationships that care comes out, that we are living the way that Christ has called us to live. Relationships are significant because they are God's means by which care is provided to his people. But secondly, and equally as important, is relationships are the means by which the gospel that is preached takes root and life in our individual lives. That is, to simply embrace the gospel intellectually without the experience of living it out in relationships is to almost not experience it at all. To the Corinthians, Paul reminds them and us that knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. Two very different realities, even of the gospel. We can learn lots about it in isolation, and it can puff up, but to experience it and live it out in relationship builds up. It's why Paul said to the church in Thessalonica, in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, that I loved you so much that I endeavored not only to share the gospel with you, but our lives, his life, and those who were with him as well. Is that Paul understood, not just in Thessalonica, because we can see it in every other aspect of his ministry, in every other location he was, that true gospel ministry was not just proclamation ministry, but it was shared life ministry. Because Paul understood that to simply speak and listen was only to live in an intellectual capacity. But to truly embrace and experience the life that this message offers meant that we would have to actually do it and order our lives around it. And this can only happen in relationships. We said earlier that the gospel leads to shared life. And for people who are committed to the gospel, what I would also suggest to you, and I think Paul's getting at in writing this to the Thessalonians, is that shared life leads to deeper embrace of the gospel. Think about this for a minute. In science class, you would have lecture and lab, right? Remember that in science class? Some of you are experiencing science class right now, although virtually. I don't know what virtual science labs look like. That could be dangerous, I suppose. But in science class, you had lecture and you had lab, because in the lecture, you learned the information. In the lab, you did it. You practiced it hands-on. You saw it. You smelled it. You experienced it. And what I would suggest to you is that Sunday proclamations are science lecture, but our shared lives outside of Sunday gathering is science lab, right? Where you're mixing ingredients together and things are happening. Or perhaps this is a better explanation or analogy, because we have lots of folks in the medical field in our congregation. Aren't you glad that the doctors that you go and see didn't just study from textbooks, but had to have experiences like clinical and residency, where they were actually seeing patients and learning from other doctors and engaging in all kinds of different relational realities where the things they were learning, they were figuring out how to apply? Aren't you grateful that your doctors had those experiences and weren't simply trying to remember pages and chapters in textbooks? What I would suggest to you is the same is true for us in the gospel. You may never be a physical doctor, but you are an agent of the gospel. And if you are only hearing it and processing it and not living it out in relational connectivity, it only goes so deep. This is why I think the writer of the letter Hebrews says to that church in Hebrews chapter 10, verse 24 and 25, while reminding them not to give up gathering together, which I would suggest to you is twofold. It means for the sacred assembly, like we're doing right now, both online and in person. We'll talk about that more next week. But it also means in this concept of sharing lives together. Don't give up on that. Why? Because of the first part of that verse. Because when you're together, you spur one another on to love and good deeds. That it only matters so much to hear what you should be doing and how the gospel can affect your life. But when you're in relationship, it actually spurs you on more and more into that reality. Let me give you just a couple of observations of how that can happen. The first is literally from observation, that in relationships we see people. We see how they are applying the gospel to their life. We see how they're interacting with their spouse, how they're treating their parents, how they're parenting or raising their kids, how they're living out gospel truths in their friendships, in their relationships, in their employment, amongst their neighbors. We see that happening in real life, and that is incredibly edifying and convicting to us. We also observe the opposite, do we not? We observe failures, and that is not to condemn the people who fail, but those too are incredibly edifying to us. First, they remind us that no one is perfect, and we can breathe a deep sigh of relief because we have seen many of our own failures. But we can also say, hey, how would have I approached that? How would have I done that differently? The simple experience of relationships is a laboratory, an observation point to see the gospel in real life and how it ought to be acted out. The second, and this comes from Hebrews chapter 10 pretty directly here, spur one another on to love and good deeds, has this idea of exhortation going on there. The Greek word parakaleo, an exhortation is in some ways a calling out, a sense of speaking boldly and firmly about something that needs to happen. But parakaleo has this idea of coming alongside of, kaleo, calling out. So calling out from close proximity. Does that make sense? That is that good exhortation or calling out or redirecting or calling a brother or sister to a different way of life usually shouldn't happen from a pulpit, but from someone right next to them. Does that make sense? And that doesn't mean, husbands or wives, that when you hear me say something, your inclination is to elbow the person next to you and say, did you hear what he said? Right? That's how we exhort people. No, the idea is that you're sharing life and observing and seeing not only the worst, but the best, and calling it out in them. Exhortation, both good and both bad, both encouraging as well as convicting. And then let me throw in another one. There are many other things we could talk about here, and I would suggest, like, meditate on this and figure this out. Relationships as a lab for gospel development. There's so many ways. Observation, exhortation. But let me also add this one. Confession. There is no greater teacher of the gospel than true confession. And to experience it, whether as the confessor or as the person receiving confession, is to taste the gospel in a deep and powerful way. I'm not talking about confession in a religious way, like a priest receiving confession. I'm talking about someone sharing with you in a vulnerable way their personal struggle. Or even someone sharing with you in a personal way their apology for how they've wronged you. Or you, in a very personal way, sharing with someone else your struggle, or sharing a heartfelt apology for how you have wronged them. Nothing could be more powerfully gospel saturated in relationships than these kinds of things. And they cause incredible growth. That's why in James chapter 5, it says that the actual experience of confession can heal us. Now, certainly, I believe that he's speaking of physical healing in that context. You come to the elders and you're prayed for. There's the experience of healing that can happen, and we practice and believe in that, not faith healing, but that God can sometimes touch us in divine healing. But there's something relationally true in that as well, that there is a healing that comes when we confess to one another back and forth in relationships. A healing that comes in the gospel. And so, true biblical community, in my mind, is defined in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. That is that we loved you so much that we determined to share not only the gospel with you. You must share the gospel, right? In words, in deeds, in saturation in your relationships, but also our lives as well. This is not a binary. It is not an either-other choice. The absence of gospel proclamation and intentionality means to simply have a friendship or a relationship. But the absence of shared life or relationship or interconnectedness is simply to preach a sermon. But when the two come together, you have the experience of biblical community that was happening in Acts chapter 2. And it just so happened to take on the form that it took on in Acts chapter 2. So my question to you is, if we believe this is true, that we're called to value the togetherness and the shared life, and that we believe it's important for our own comfort and care, as well as for our own gospel growth, then what would it mean to lean into it together? Not trying to recreate Acts chapter 2, which was contextual, but believing that some kind of true experience of biblical community could and would rise that would give us the experience of true life that we taste and see in Acts chapter 2. When I was a freshman in college, I distinctly remember this. Showing up and the president of the student body standing up in front of the whole incoming freshman class and saying something. He said, "College has all kinds of opportunities for you, but you will get from it what you put into it." In other words, if you close yourself off in isolation, you'll get and education, right? But if you give yourself into the community, the experience of college life, you will gain that much more. I think the same could be said of the experience of the church. There is something to be gained in isolation, simply showing up on Sundays and hearing and receiving. But true life, the true experience of what it means to be the people of God, only happens if you're willing to take the risk of putting yourself out there to experience it. In some sense, that you get what you are willing to give. And so I suppose my exhortation for you, even if it is from a proverbial pulpit and not right next to you, is, would you take that risk with me? I'm not asking you to clear your schedule. I'm not asking you to become an extrovert. I'm asking you to believe that adding in some experiences of shared life could actually lead to a fuller life for you, but also for us as a church. So, I promise you one step that you could potentially take. One step that seems to be significant from Jump Street in the experience of the church. Again, please hear me. The purpose of this teaching is not to make you feel bad or to make you leave here feeling like you're doing everything wrong. It's to tempt you. Is tempt an okay word for a preacher to say? I don't know. There's probably a better word than tempt, but I'm going to go with tempt. To tempt you with the idea that there could be something worthwhile in this for you to take a risk and go for it. Here's the risk that I think you can take. And I'll summarize the risk in one word. The word is table. The table in the New Testament and in the experience of the church is significant. And by table, I do not mean the altar or the table where the communion meal is on. I mean the table where we share meals together. In fact, communion rose out of shared meals, even in the early church. They would get together in the morning at the temple for some kind of ceremony or gathering, and then later that night, they would gather in houses for a meal, and they would eat together. And as part of that, they would share the communion meal as well. And then ultimately, that meal would lead into a time of teaching afterwards that eventually became the church, and somehow we're doing it this way 2,000 years later, right? Everything morphs, and that's okay. But from its inception, the table was there's some kind of magic. Can I use the word magic in a church too? I'm saying tempt and magic. Things are going off the rails quickly. There's some kind of spark that happens at a table in a sharing of a meal that presents the atmosphere where we can let our guards down a little bit and experience some sense of shared life. So today I'm not asking you to make a bunch of best friends, though you could be beginning to do that. I'm asking you, what would it mean even once a month? Or if that seems overwhelming to you now, once every other month, to say, I'm going to value the table, and I'm going to either open up my table to someone else or to some other people, or I'm going to accept an invitation from someone else who has opened up their table. In your home, at a restaurant, in a park, wherever it might be, something happens there. In fact, if you look at the ministry of Jesus, I would suggest to you that though his preaching was phenomenal, and it was, and though his miracles were miraculous, and they were, perhaps the most significant element of his ministry was the table. and who he continually invited to and the invitations that he accepted to eat with people, we see incredible conversions happening at the table, not just at preaching and miracles. It's at the table where Zacchaeus says, I'm going to sell everything and follow Jesus. It's at the table where tax collectors give up their wayward life of thievery and selfishness and arrogance and decide to follow Jesus. It's at the table where people are healed. It's at a proverbial table around a well where a Samaritan woman is gathered in to the heart of Jesus. What might happen at your kitchen table or your dining room table or the table at the Outback right over here? What might happen at the table that you were invited to participate in? If the gospel and relationships are there, the table might just be the place that begins to unleash an even fuller experience of life. Are we called to be Acts chapter 2 people? Unequivocally, I think the answer is yes. Does it have to look like that? No, that was contextual. Are you busy? I believe you are. Do you have a certain kind of personality? I believe you do. Guess what? I'm busy and I have a certain kind of personality too. What I'm asking us to do is to believe this is significant enough to take some risks. Risks with our time, risks with our home, risks with our relationships, in order to lean into this idea of loving people enough to not only share the gospel, but our lives as well. The New Testament church is near universally defined in the first person plural, we, not me. Can I pray with you?